Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And if you heard Star Trek, that was Monty Mann from Take 12 Radio. And as a favor, he did that. He usually charges for doing that. And he did us a favor. We did an interview with him, and he did one with us. And it went really well. I was real impressed both times. My interview was pretty impressive to me, probably nobody else, but as a favor, he put that together. And the interesting part about that is I send out misses, which are messages on my Facebook and Friends of Friends, Serendipitous, or God's Plan, people get them. It's really amazing that who gets them, because how big is Facebook? How big is the world? And the people who get them usually are in recovery, and they're kind of surprised that they got them. And I really believe it's a God deal. I don't believe there's any coincidences. And so when I send those out, you have to be a little bit neurotic and have plenty of time on your hands to do that. In the background, I'm usually listening to Star Trek. Now, Monty didn't know that. So I believe things like that to me are God shots. The coincidences are, there is no coincidence. That was supposed to be. So thanks again, Monty. And if you want to hear some really good recovery, it's Take 12 Radio with Monty the Man. It's great stuff, and he's been doing it for years. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse. And they afford us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audiences in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation because they believe in what we're doing is a powerful medium in recovery. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. Normally, I would introduce at this time my co-host and my sponsor, by the way, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. Harold's at a convention in his chosen profession and was not able to be on with us tonight. And that's all right. Harold does a great work with families. And I believe that the family is the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. And I believe most of the drug and alcohol problems we have is because of the breakdown of the family. And the family is being beset on all sides. And the drug and alcohol precipitate out of the inability of most parents to teach their children correct principles of morality. So once the morality of the fabric of the nation, the fabric of the nation is being torn and the morality is going asunder, and it's showing itself in drug and alcohol addiction. We have, according to Google, you folks know Google, 1,000 years from now, the archaeologists and the anthropologists will conclude that they all commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And according to Google, there's 140 million alcoholics in the world. I think there's probably more, But that's what Google says, that's what the problem looks like. Gee, so we might be just throwing starfishes back into the ocean, and there's a million starfishes out there, and we're not going to get them all, but we can get the ones we can get, and that's why we do this. I'd like to start off the show, before I introduce my interview for tonight, and it looks to be really exciting. Spike is here. He's really... old time. Okay. All right. Well, click them off. He's really quite an interesting fellow. He's got quite the bio. If you take a look at the website, an actor, a stuntman. He's been around the world, European, has a broader sense of what's going on. And his story is really interesting, exciting, and informative. And I would suggest if you have the opportunity to jump in. I like to start the show before I introduce him and we get started. I like to start with the third step prayer. And I believe that it's a good way to start things in recovery. In most places, it's called an invocation. We invite in the spirit. We do this quite often. This is one of the standard prayers in AA. And to remind you, we do not represent AA. We do not represent NA. CA, we're probably closest to Paranoid Anonymous, but the problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. This is Rum Radio. We use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's the template of all 12-step recoveries. And folks, let me tell you, no matter what the drug of choice is, more people die of alcohol, from alcohol, than all the other drugs combined. Alcohol is a drug. We're all, when we say sister, we're all sister and brothers in recovery. The flavor of the disease is irrelevant to the decimation it causes. So when I get a new sponsee, and this is the first assignment I give them, I also call the third step prayer, the surrender prayer. I ask the newcomer, got his beginner's chip, have you had enough? Yes or no. Usually if they've had enough, they don't ask, but I'll ask anyway. Some will say, well, what do you mean enough? I said, have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough alcohol? Yes or no? Yes. Are you willing to go to any lengths to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. Okay. You can't, and I tell them, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I give them Clancy 7 questions. They're on the website underneath the sponsorship tab. 7 little questions, not to replace a 4th step or anything like that, but they're probing questions. I'm not interested in much as how they answer it. It's a good little platform to get an understanding where they're at. The idea is they've been given simple and direct, simple instruction. And if they're willing to go to any length, then I need that back tomorrow. So I want to see if this guy's ready to go. Now, if I don't get him back tomorrow, usually I don't get him back at all, he's either not ready or he's not ready for me. My style is a little forward, and it's not for everybody, but it seems to work really well. Most of the folks I work with end up maintaining it, attaining and then maintaining long-term sobriety. Because I try to get them into sponsorship as quickly as possible. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. And the first assignment is to get a home group. This is the group that they're going to be going to on a regular basis. It's their lifeline group. And in that group, to get the name of 20, 30, or how many fellas he can get in there, and I also suggest men with men, women with women, it's easier to identify with the same gender. The other problem is sponsorship is very intimate. So it could be easily misconstrued when it's an opposite sex and when sex changes everything. So the direction is, or the suggestion is, you work the steps. If the best you're going to do, you hook up with an opposite sex and you need to work the steps, you work the steps. Don't worry about it, but my suggestion is same gender works better, or for the most from most my understanding. And then during that time, you get this fella's names, you get their phone numbers, and that's your lifeline because you can't get a hold of your sponsor, which happens quite often. We all have cell phones nowadays, but nobody ever answers, unless it's about money or romance. Then the phone's answered, there's no doubt about it. And ask them permission to recite the third step prayer, and I do that because I always tell them why, to get used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Connects them up with their home group. They get to know his name. They get to know, he gets to know their name. What we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps, the third step encapsulates what our goal is. Also, the fourth reason, the fellow he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first. And he probably will not. No guarantee, but your sponsee's already into service work, which is the key to long-term recovery. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I'll take an amen on that every time. I'd like to introduce my interview for tonight. He goes by Papa Spike, and we'll call him Spike. He's a very interesting fellow. He's going to tell us about his experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what is it like now, and what is his passion that keeps him in maximum service to God and his fellows. Are you there, Spike?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, so tell us.
Good morning.
Good morning. I know it's 3 o'clock in the morning in merry old England. It's less than nine here. So thank you so much for taking that effort. I know that's a hard thing to do. Your pictures show you that you're a tough guy, that you could bite nails and spit them out. That's what it looks like. But, you know, no matter how tough we are, alcohol is always a little bit tougher. I've seen some really tough guys being put down on their knees, no matter how tough they thought they were. So tell us, what was it like?
Well, basically, with me, I started playing professional rugby in South Africa for about 10 years, and I was on steroids and playing in front of, on TV every weekend. And towards the end of my career, because I had a really good physique and tattoos and stuff, kind of like David Beckham, I was offered a modeling contract in L.A. So after I retired, I went off to L.A., and until I had gotten to L.A., I had never touched a drug or smoked a cigarette in my life. You know, I was a health freak. And after the first modeling shoot, there was a rap party, and everybody was doing cocaine. And I was like, they were all like, Spike, do a line, do a line. I was like, no, I ain't touching that. And then one day I gave in and did a line, and I got hooked and developed about $500 a day habit for about 6 years. And I've still kept on working, and I got into movies and doing stunt work and modeled all over the world for about 10 years. And then one day, basically, I was cooking dinner, and I married the lead actress in one of the shows I was doing, TV shows I was doing. I was cooking dinner, and it felt like somebody stabbed me through the heart with a huge knife, and I collapsed on the floor, and I called my wife. I said, call an ambulance, something's wrong. And she thought I was kidding, and she went back to bed. 3 hours later, she woke up panicking, so I wasn't in bed next to her, ran in the kitchen, found me ice cold on the floor, no pulse, nothing. She thought I was dead. Called the police saying, my husband's died on my kitchen floor. The police arrived in a few minutes later, apparently, with an ambulance, and they put an adrenaline needle through my heart, got my heart pumping long enough to get me to the operating theater. And when they opened me up, they saw that my entire aorta from my heart went down to my legs. It exploded and split in half. And it's a miracle I'm still here. I went into a coma for 6 weeks. They want to amputate both my legs because of lack of blood flow. Apparently, I flatlined twice for over 10 minutes. And my parents came down. They lived in England, and they came to see me in hospital, and they stayed by my side all the whole time. The doctors told them to say goodbye to me because I was clinically dead. And they called a priest in, gave my benediction, and somehow, by some miracle of God, I survived. And
did you call on God yourself, or were you?
Well, I was in a coma, so
spiritual. Usually, when you're in that, people get real. Real spiritual, real quick. But what was your experience?
I've been a Roman Catholic my entire life. I've never been a major churchgoer or anything like that. But I've always believed in God, and I've prayed every single day of my life, you know. But since this accident, I thank God every second of every day for giving me another chance at life. You know, there's not a second of any day that I don't thank him for saving my life, you know.
And give me another chance for you. I got a question back up a little bit. When you told your wife that, you know, there was a problem, you know, that you were really hurt badly, she ignored that because were you a jokester by nature?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a very sarcastic sense of humor. Maybe she thought I was kidding. I have no idea. But, you know, anyway, but when I came out of the coma, my father was holding my hand really, really tight, and he had tears in his eyes. I had never seen my father cry in my entire life. And I was like, "Papa, what are you doing crying?" He says, "We thought we had lost you twice." I said, "But I'm here. I have no idea what had happened to me." And then I said, where's my wife? And she said, "You're not going to like this." I said, "What do you mean? We're going to knock on our hotel door, open the door, no one there, a big bag of clothes and a note on it saying, don't ever try and contact me again. That's it, I'm gone." And I don't know if she left because the doctors told her I'd be brain dead, paraplegic, never father a child, never walk again. Maybe it was too much for her. You know, she's only 25, a beautiful woman with a great career ahead of her. Maybe she didn't want to be responsible for that. I have no idea. I've yet to ever speak to her again. So,
how many years ago?
Very,
was
very
that?
Strange. It was in 1997, so 15, 17 years ago.
Yeah, going on 17 years. And not a word. She's probably embarrassed, probably, for doing that. But there's no telling.
I honestly have no idea. But funny enough, I don't hold any grudges or have any hard feelings towards her, you know, because I feel it was all self-induced. I did it to myself, and I'm the only one responsible for doing what I did, you know, which was what caused me to basically almost die, you know.
So that was the, and then after that, now did you go back and were you doing drugs? Okay, now that you've had you considered that a spiritual experience, right? That you
saved
your life.
Yeah,
no,
definitely.
God, somehow you were given a second chance now. Now what are you going to do with that chance? What did you do with it?
Well, basically, my parents flew me back to England and they turned one of their rooms in their house into basically a hospital room. Almost like intensive care. And I went from about 245 pounds of solid muscle to about 109 pounds of skin and bones. And I was so weak for about 2 years. I laid in bed. I was paralyzed from the waist down. And I couldn't lift my arms off the bed. I couldn't lift my head off the pillow. I had 24-hour nurses looking after me. And I thought my life was over. You know, and all I could do is stare at a ceiling, you know, for 2 years, a little over 2 years, and that almost killed me. But somehow...
How was your legs? Were your legs okay? I mean, you could feel your legs?
No. I was totally paralyzed in the waist.
Paralyzed? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, from the hips down, from the neck down, how far?
From the hips down.
Hips down, totally paralyzed.
Yeah. So anyway, so after the 2.5 years, I was in a wheelchair for 4 or 5 years, told I'd never walk again, you know, and all that. And then one day I came home and I said to my father, I don't care what it costs, give me the best physiotherapist money you can buy. I'm going to teach myself to walk again. My father said, Spike, your legs are dead. They wanted to cut them off. There's no way you can walk. I said, I'm doing it. And for the next couple of years, 4 or 5 hours a day of the tough, hardest, most painful physiotherapy you can imagine, I taught myself to walk by some miracle. And I walk with a limp, but I'm walking, you know. And it's just, I don't know, I have no idea how I did it. I don't know why I did it, but I know I've done it, you know. And basically, I've published my autobiography and my book just to show people that no matter how bad things are, or how all these people that are bedridden or have given up on life or are stuck in wheelchairs, if they want to get out of that bed or out of that wheelchair, they can. It's hard work, but you can do it. But only you yourself can do it, you know. And it's just amazing the amount of lives that I've touched and inspired and motivated, that have totally turned their lives around just by reading my book. You know, it's just that really touches me more than anything.
I've read stories, just the miracles like Think and Grow Rich and some of the positive stories about one fellow who's in an airplane crash, and there was not much left of him. And he ended up walking out of the hospital. I mean, it was miraculous that he had put in his mind so much that he was going to accomplish this feat, that his body actually regenerated itself in a manner that normally is not available by medical science standards.
No, I know. It's the same with me, you know. I had the best heart surgeon from Houston, Texas, operate on me, and he said to me, Spike, normally on the operating table, if the aorta splits a centimeter, less than an inch, you lose the patient every time, and mine split from my heart all the way down to my legs. It's an absolute miracle I'm still here. And no one, I've spoken to the best heart surgeons in Europe, in England, America, South America, South Africa, and all of them cannot believe that I'm alive. You know, and there's obviously a reason for it, you know.
And walking.
And walking.
Yeah. Well, he who limps is still walking.
Not, yeah. My left leg is totally paralyzed still. My right leg's about 60% live. What they managed to do, they cut my left leg in 8 places, and they put a femoral bypass, and they flushed the blood through for about 3 to 4 weeks. And my right leg came back to life from the knee up. But my lower legs are still 100% dead. It's just amazing. I'm walking and breathing, to be honest.
Well, that's a great... it doesn't sound like you were on drugs all that long, although what I've noticed, especially today... Pardon me?
I was on drugs, doing crack cocaine for about 6 years, and doing cocaine, marijuana, and acid, and ecstasy for about 10 years.
Ah, okay. So this accumulated. When you were in the movie business, now I'm not familiar with that. That's an alien environment to me, and I'm sure most folks don't get into that. But the assumption is that the drugs are very available and easily obtained.
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. In the whole entertainment world, whether you're a musician, artists, writers, movie stars, I mean, drugs like cocaine and heroin are so available, it's scary.
Oh, that's part of the whole culture then, huh? Yeah, that's what
exactly.
That's what we would assume. I would assume that now, what I've noticed, I belong to a primary purpose here in Houston. That's my home group. And I've noticed that the people coming in are younger and younger. Most of the time, it used to be an alcoholic would come in. Drugs weren't all that big back when this thing started, when AA started. It wasn't that big. It was kind of a rare deal, and it was underground kind of deal. Alcohol has always been a plague, but, you know, the drugs were not as rampant. You know, the dope fiend, you know, the whole onus about that, it was all underground. Now the drugs seem to be as prevalent as the alcohol.
Oh, yes.
The good news is that it hits the kids down to the ground so much harder and so much faster that they're finding their way into the rooms.
Yeah, I mean, even in schools, I mean, from the age of 12, 14, a lot of drugs that are going around, it's scary. You know, in America, in England, everywhere I've ever lived, drugs are just flowing through the school systems. It's just sad. It's crazy.
And why do you think? Because the parents, they're getting no moral compass at home. They're not being taught correctly in school.
Personally, I think it's peer pressure from, you know, all the cool dudes. You know, they go to a party on the weekend and everybody's doing smoking weed. That's how they usually start, is to smoke weed. And then the weed becomes not enough and they need heroin or they need cocaine or acid or ecstasy or mushrooms. And, you know, and it just, you know, it just rolls on and on. It just gets worse and worse, you know.
So you were like 10 years doing drugs. Now, did it all start with the steroids? The steroids was...
Yeah, well, I started taking steroids when I was a professional athlete because to compete at that level was kind of hard not to, sadly. There's so much money involved in sports nowadays that if you don't take steroids, you can't compete at that level, you know? And that's how I started with it and how I got into drugs. I mean, I wouldn't say steroids is a narcotic, but it is dangerous, as dangerous as cocaine or anything else.
What's the, do you feel an intoxicant high from steroids? You get a buzz?
No, you don't get a buzz. I mean, your self-confidence goes through the roof, which is a good thing, I guess. And you just feel it basically invincible, you know. I mean, when I was on steroids and an athlete, you know, I felt untouchable. You know, even when I was doing coke, I was still training in the gym 5-6 hours a day, and I actually felt invincible, you know, and... The steroids give you this false sense of security and self-confidence. It's mad. And the worst thing about steroids, the more you take, the more you think you're going to get bigger, but it's not the case. And that's when it becomes dangerous.
More is better?
No, it's not better. You know.
No, I mean psychologically, but, you think that if I take a little bit, I'm going to be a little better. If I take more, I'm going to be more better. And if I take a lot, I'm going to be that much more better.
Exactly.
With no end in sight.
Because, I mean, the problem with steroids, it raises your blood pressure. Your blood pressure goes through the roof, and that's what's dangerous. And that's what made my heart explode, the combination of the cocaine and the steroids.
Now, were you doing the steroids and the cocaine at the time your heart exploded?
Yeah.
So you were high at the time when it happened?
Yeah, I was very high. I had just gone from just left the gym. I had just spent 3 hours in the gym, and I had just taken a couple of injections of Sustanon, which is testosterone. Got home, did a few lines of coke and a couple of hits of crack, and tried to make myself some dinner, and boom.
Wow, yeah.
I was doing that every single day, you know. And the worst thing with crack, it gets so bad that you'll give up anything. I've seen friends lose their houses, their Ferraris, their Porsches. I mean, with me, it got so bad. I had a $10,000 Rolex. that I gave to a drug dealer for 1 gram of coke one night. You know, and that's how desperate you get, you know.
Wow, that's presidential gold. Sure, they would take that more now, but yeah, sure. That's amazing. I tried cocaine back in the day. We used to call it freebasing. They didn't have crack at the time. It was you'd boil it up in some water with some baking soda, and then it would crystallize, and you would take the rocks and smoke that. I guess it was a pure form, and I tried it. You know, cure. I was an alcoholic. I would drink most of the time, but anything that come past your way. Women really liked the cocaine. You know, that was the allure for me. You know, if you got an 8-ball of coke and you put it on the kitchen table, it was kind of miraculous. Within a few minutes, a coke whore would be knocking at the door, and it was like the essence of the coke whore was in the 8-ball. It was just amazing how women just kind of flocked to it.
Oh,
I tried it. I tried it for like 8 hours, and I was with a lady friend of mine. We're just friends, and I said, "Yeah, that's enough for me." And I went to bed, and she said, "You know," and she continued to smoke for the next couple of days. And I said, "You know, really, it doesn't do all that much for me. I'm more of I'm a social guy, so I want to go party." And the whole routine, the ritual of putting this together, just left me flat. But you know, but I saw people, she would smoke 2-3 days or longer. And then she'd be hiding behind the curtain, you know, or grabbing my pant leg because she would be seeing, you know, people bouncing out under the bushes in this complete paranoia. And she just loved it. You know, I guess you have to be there to do that. So you went through a fortune.
Yeah, I spent a fortune. I mean, I was earning up to $10,000 a day. Basically, when I was modeling and stuff, you know. And I blew most of it just on coke and crack and, you know. It's just, I didn't spend that much a day on it, but I'm just saying.
Oh, okay. You were making that kind of money in the professional world of modeling and then when did the movie, so you did the movies, you were a stuntman, so you were a physical specimen when you were in the movies doing stunt work.
Yeah.
And then from there, you garnered a reputation, tough guy and real macho, and then the modeling agency was looking for that look.
Right. I was the first international bald model with tattoos, and that was like 20 years ago, more than that, like 25 years ago. And now it's like a trend. Half the models are bald and tattooed.
Matter of fact, I had just seen a billboard and here in Houston, and it said doctors that, you know, remove your tattoo.
Yeah.
I think we might be on the backside of that fashion. Well, it happens, you know. I always wonder when I see, and you know, I have a small one that an ex-wife had me put on to mark me in an eagle before I went to Vietnam. I had those going on, but I always, when I see these really pretty young women and all covered in tattoos, I kind of picture them, what they're going to look like when they're like 60 or 70 years old and the skin's hanging. You're not going to be able to see much of that tattoo anymore.
Oh, I know.
It's silly when you're a kid.
Yeah. No, I don't mind small tattoos here and there on a woman, but woman covered in tattoos is not my cup of tea, so to speak.
No, and some of them, you know, they're very pretty, almost beautiful, and then they're like they're marring their body, you know, and I think some of them do that so they don't look that good, you know. I guess, I don't know, it's hard to say. It's just like, you know, it's like, honey, why did you do that? You know, where they have it on their face and just like, oh, brother. So okay, so let's get back now to your you've written several books, I think, right? A couple books.
No, I've written one book. What happened is when I spent the 2.5 years in bed, When I came out of bed, my father said to me, you need to go see a psychiatrist. And I said to him, I don't need to see a psychiatrist. I'm taking you to see a psychiatrist. And he took me to London to see the top psychiatrist there. And I saw her for two sessions. And after the second session, she said to me, Spike, the best therapy for you to do is to go home from here, get a notepad, and start writing down all your emotions, your feelings, anything that comes to your mind, just write it down. And I said to her, I'm an athlete. I've never written a word in my life. She said, trust me, do it. And I went home that night. I got a notepad, and I started writing. And I wrote nonstop for 3 or 4 hours. And I found it so therapeutic. And for the next couple of years, I used to write every single day for a couple of hours a day. And I absolutely loved writing it. But I never showed anybody what I was writing. And then a couple of years down the road, my best friend from Florida, Joe, came to see me. And I showed him what I was writing, the first person I ever showed any of it to. And he was also a big guy. He started crying. I'm like, dude, what the hell are you doing crying? He says, I've never read anything more inspirational, motivational. You need to publish this. I said, I can't publish a book. Are you mad? And then only about 18 months ago, because I'm never allowed to work again because of my health, I've had 4 open heart surgeries since then to repair everything that's gone wrong with me. So I thought maybe I should publish it. So I published it myself, and I did I signed with a publishing company, and I published it myself. But I didn't even edit it. I designed it. Cover. I did everything myself, cover to cover, and published it. And it's just gone through the roof, you know. And then in December, I found out that my publisher hadn't paid me a cent of any of the royalties I had made from selling my book. And I found out that publishing companies take advantage of first-time authors, knowing full well they don't have the money to take them to court. So now I've republished it with a new publisher here in England, who's just a good friend and a great woman, called Steph Coe. And and she gives me 80% of my royalties, and it's just amazing. And we do it on print on demand, and it's a third edition that's been slightly edited, and it's just going through the roof. It's unbelievable.
Let me backtrack a little bit. Did you do any of the groups? Did you go to AA or NA or CA? Did you try that format at all?
I think my heart exploding was my AA or CA, whatever you want to call it. I think that was enough to make me sober. But I went to a CA meeting about a year ago, actually, for the first time. And I told them my story, and they were just totally mesmerized with it. And funny enough, I've made quite a few friends. I only went once to one meeting, because I was too poorly to go there by car or to drive. I'm not allowed to drive or anything, so I wasn't able to attend the meetings. But I found it quite fascinating, actually, what they do.
It is. The website we put together, it's about really getting back to a basics formula. When addiction recovery through the AA, the 12-step process, the Big Book, started, and they were very. If you ever read the Big Book, I would recommend it highly. It's the first instruction is read this book. No matter how far down you've gone or how far up you've come, that it's a great read. It really is. It'll give you insights into your own personality, and I bet once you read that book, you'll write another book once you read that.
Yeah.
It's spiritually enlivened. Thoughts will come that you excuse me?
Sorry, I'm just coughing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thoughts will come to you because of the spiritual enlivenment of the work. It says in there, originally when people came into AA, 50% got well right away, and the other 25% in a very short period of time. So it was almost like a 75% recovery rate initially when they first started, and that's the website goes back to that understanding of sponsorship. Yours is a little different story. I mean, you had yours was you shouldn't even be alive. Most alcoholics and drug addicts only have so many options. It's either a spiritual solution, death, or incarceration, insanity.
Exactly.
And that's it. I went to a psychiatrist one time, and he said, do you see things that other people don't see? He says, and do you hear things that other people don't hear? And I responded, doesn't everyone? And he said, you know, I can work with you.
Yeah.
So I tell people, we're all here because we're all not there. So it's a form of insanity. And you could, now looking back, I'm sure you could see how insane that all was. What you gave up, the cost. And,
no.
You know, right? Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's giving a life. It takes a life.
Yeah.
That's what drugs and alcohol do. They take lives. We have a saying in the program that goes, the man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes a man.
Yeah.
There's a lot between AA and NA that, you know, you have, when you have drug addicts and alcoholics together, there's going to be some kind of conflict that's not really necessary. They call it singleness of purpose, that, you know, the alcoholic should be with the alcoholic and the drug addict with the drug addict. I disagree with that formula because drugs and alcohol are kissing cousins. I've never met a drug addict that didn't drink, and I never met a drunk that didn't do drugs, at least to some degree. If the drug is there and you're going to take it, if you know, what's going to stop you? You know, like, hey, this might get me higher. You know, like, you're not going to, no. I'm sorry, I only do scotch. You know, it's not going to happen, my experience.
Yeah.
So now
yeah,
go ahead.
I totally agree with you there. Funny enough, my girlfriend, Ali, she used to be a serious heroin addict, and she did a rehab program called Narconon, and she opened up a center here in England where we live, and she's been helping and saving people's lives for 15 years, and also an amazing program Narconon is, and it's just phenomenal. The, you know, how she's helped me, you know, and she's just so supportive and just a beautiful soul. It's just amazing.
That's funny you should say that, because I say that, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, because I do the Al-Anon program as well. And here they usually call it a double winner. But when I introduce myself into a mixed meeting, and I go to a conference that have mixed meetings, they have an AA chair and an Al-Anon chair, and I'll introduce myself as an Al-Anon.
No, it's Narconon.
Oh, okay. Say that again?
Narconon.
Narconon. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. See, I do hear things that other people don't hear. A Narconon. Okay, well, now I got
something. You've been smoking the funny stuff tonight.
No, I'm just naturally a little bit of a whack job. I come by it naturally now. I used to have to do it synthetically. For me, it was a conscious contact with my creator. That's really what made the big change with me. It got back into the religion of my father's, you know, and then AA was able to make that platform that I could get back to the God of my father, which is Jesus. Jesus is my higher power. And I have sponsees that don't know who God is or what God is or anything, and I say, I still suggest that they pray, but they can address it to whom it may concern. and that'll get them started. But that Jesus works for me, you know, and that's okay. I'll mention in a meeting, it's funny, you know, like I have no problem with it. It's funny in AA, if you mention that you have a rock or a tree or the light bulb or a doorknob, no one will think twice about it. You say Jesus in a mixed meeting, you're going to get a passionate response for good or for ill. And I say, isn't that curious? That's the only name that does that. And they kind of like, they wince a little bit. I'm the guy in Houston everybody loves to hate. You know, I'm trying to get him back to the, I'm trying to get him back. You know, let me tell you, drunks are tough. They don't like any change. Even if the change is going back to the original concept, they'll fight you tooth and nail. But I tell them this. I said you might go kicking and screaming, but going you are. So now the book is available for purchase.
It's available for purchase through my website. My website is www.anaughtythingcalledlife.com. And if you go on the website, there's a link at right at the top towards the right called Buy the Book Here. And click on that and you can order the Kindle version, the PDF, or the actual paperback. And it's quite a story, I tell you. I'm in the process of trying to work on a movie deal to have a movie made of it as well. And that's happening too. I've got a great screenplay writer from Hollywood who's writing the script for me. And it's going to be amazing to see it on the big screen as well, because it's going to touch a lot of lives.
The thing is that you're able to regenerate. Now, do you do spirituality or you do religious? What's your flavor now?
I'm Roman Catholic. I was born Roman Catholic, and I've always been Roman Catholic, you know. But like I say, I don't go to church. Occasionally, I go to church if someone takes me, but I don't go to church every Sunday like a lot of people. But I do pray and thank God for giving me another chance every single day of my life.
Well, you go Christmas and Easter though, right? Don't you?
Times like that, I'll definitely go. Yeah.
Yeah. I called my brother up and I said, Robert, I'm a convert to another religion, but I was a Catholic and then converted. And my brother's Catholic, and I called him up Easter. You know, and I go, did you go to church? No, I was too busy. Gosh, Robert, not even Easter. You got to be kidding me. At least go Easter. You know, but I don't get it. I don't get, you know, I try to go on a regular basis. I made this up. You know why old men study the scriptures?
Why?
They're cramming for final exams. You know, and my dad is 93. I couldn't get him to open up a Bible. Couldn't do it. I tried it, and I consider myself a failure. I'm salesman by trade and businessman, and I put all my resources trying to convince him, and I think he did it one time for 5 minutes, and that was the most he could do. And you would think at that age he would be, you know, gobbling it up, but no, he's not going to go there. I find in the program that the spirituality is really the key to long-term happiness. For me it is, anyway, and I've noticed people that have really embraced this, grow spiritually, they grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, the more spiritual I become, the more effective I am in helping my next, you know, the next sufferer. I would say this: when I'm in the service of my fellow beings, am I not in the service of my God? And when I'm in that service and in that moment, am I not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when I make my conscious contact with my Creator, who lives from moment to moment eternity to eternity, life everlasting. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. So your action is writing the book and now getting the movie put together. Do you do anything with anybody else, though? Do you do any service work at all? Or
what I'm trying to get going is to become a motivational speaker, to go to the schools in the areas, in the area that I live in, and to go speak to rehab centers. I help the Knocking On Center in Holland quite a bit, and things like that. I'd like to go to do motivational speaking to companies and share my story, because it's not only about drugs. It's very inspirational. It's very motivational. Give people hope, and it's not, put it this way, my life story is not called a naughty thing called life for nothing. I used to be one hell of a naughty boy in my time, and there's not much I haven't done. But I've come right. My ex-wife gave birth to the most beautiful little angel, who I call Angelina, 7 years ago. And she's given me the strength to keep going and keep fighting, and she's just an amazing little creature and a gift from God. I tell you, she's just so beautiful.
Oh, I know. I was with I've had two daughters die from this disease.
Really?
And that's really part of the motivation to do Rum Radio, because there's no money being made. I do this as a passion. Hopefully this will save someone else from going through that. So I didn't make an amends to my youngest daughter. I kept planning on it, and she passed away on me. And she produced a granddaughter, Claire. And she's the sweetest thing. So as part of the amends to my daughter, I'm the very best grandfather I could be to her daughter. And she just, we have such a great relationship. It's just unbelievable. The other week we were together in the car, and it was a lot of traffic, always road construction here in Houston, and lots of traffic. And I'm complaining, and I'm saying, Claire, I'm really tired of this traffic. And she goes, I really like the traffic, Papa. I says, well, yeah, that's because you're not driving. I says, why do you like the traffic, Claire? She says, because it gives me more time to spend with you, Papa.
Oh, how beautiful is that, huh?
I know, and she does stuff like that all the time. She said, I feel so special that someone comes every Saturday and teaches me.
Wow.
So normally she goes, how do you know all this stuff, Papa? I said, well, I have a library card. And that's my stock answer when she, So we're at Johnson Space Center about 8 months, well, it's almost a year ago. She just had turned 8. And we're at Johnson Space, and she asked me a question. I said, Claire, I really don't know. And she turned around and she says, what's the matter, honey? Honey, lose your library card? Huh? just some of the stuff she comes out with now. And children are given words that confound the wise and the learned. So make no mistake, they're taking it in. And if you give them the correct information early enough, you teach them correct principles, when you do have to let them go, they'll have a basis of understanding that will keep them on the right path most of their life. My experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was that?
To me, family is absolutely everything to me. It's just my parents, my sister, my brothers. They're all spread around the world, and we still talk on a daily basis. And it's just, my family is my world, my life. My daughter is just my little angel from the heavens. She's just beautiful. About my book, like I said, go on my website, www.anotherthingcalledlife.com, and you can purchase my book there. You can read the synopsis. You can look at all my pictures and videos on there. And please, you know, tell all your friends about it. It's quite a story.
Well, I'm sure they will. We'll get a few more minutes left. And what I'm hoping you do that when you go around and do you don't have to be an assigned motivational speaker. I'm sure the schools would be more than happy for you to come down and tell some of the kids what you went through, or, you know, go to the coaches, you know, the kids that might be taking steroids and what to expect.
Yeah.
And what happened to you. You know, you'd be surprised when they're, especially the young kids, when they see things like that, even elementary school, you know, you go there and you tell them that story, and it'll make an impact. The younger, the better.
I know it will, you know, and like the last sentence in my book, I say, if I can change one person's life by reading my book, I will be one happy man, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart, you know? And it's just amazing that the thousands of lives that I've already affected just by reading my book. It's just phenomenal.
That's great. I know exactly how you know, from doing the website, I came up with a lot of stuff that I put on there. And if you think you can change the world, it's either grandiose romanticism or politics. The only way you change the world is one man at a time.
Exactly.
And I had that experience one time. I was in one of the clubs that here in Houston, and I hand out these little cards, you know, to get you to the website, to introduce the website. And I was giving it to this one fellow, and he says, oh, you gave me one about 6 months ago. I said, well, that's great. I says, he said, I gave it to my sponsor. He loves it. It's all over Dallas. I said, I'm glad to hear that. He says, you know that part where you have that sponsor is suicidal? I says, yeah, it's the sincerest form of self-criticism. It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and it's also considered a slip. He says, you know, when I read that it was also considered a slip, that's when I decided not to kill myself.
Yeah.
We got a caller. Let's see. I think somebody's got a question for you. Hold up. Caller?
Yeah.
You have a question for Spike?
Yes, I do.
Well, go right ahead.
Okay, great. Hi, Spike. How are you?
I'm very fine. And you? And who is this?
My name is Joy. I'm from New Jersey.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing good tonight. How are you?
I am very, very well, actually. A bit tired.
Well,
it's about 4 in the morning here.
I know it is, because I'm at the Jersey Shore and I'm in New Jersey, and yes, I know it's very late for you. I was listening to the whole conversation about the drugs and the alcohol, and, you know, not so much for you for the alcohol and everything, but I mean, I've fought with addiction for a very long time. And I did crack cocaine for many, many years. And, you know, with the grace of God, it never affected me as it has affected you. You tell me, after you had the episode in the kitchen where you were feeling the pain or feeling like you were having a heart attack,
right.
What were your feelings on that? Like, what were you thinking in your head, or why didn't you go to the phone yourself and call 911? What happened? What was going through your mind?
I mean, the pain, I had never felt pain like that. It was so painful. Basically, all I could do as I was falling, I called my wife. I said, call an ambulance. I thought she had, and then I passed out. So the pain was so intense that I basically passed out right there and then. By the time I hit the floor, I was out cold. So, you know, people always ask me, did I see the light and all that? And to be honest with you, I honestly can't remember. I think I was that far.
You passed out.
Yeah, I was so far gone.
So after, after all everything that you've been through in your life with your medical history and how you're paralyzed, and then you have the help of your family and friends and the birth of your beautiful angel, Angelina, I think it gave you inspiration to go forward. I really believe that Angelina was part of you wanting to live life in the fullest and try to inspire people. And I think that's why you created your story so that it could get out to other people that suffer from the feeling or the health issue that you've been through. So in writing your book, what has made an inspiration on you to do this, to inspire other people, besides the inspiration of your daughter? Like, that must be the most greatest thing in the world, that when they said that you couldn't have children and you bared a child.
Exactly. I mean, from the second she was born, I actually felt like I came alive again, because until then, to be honest, I actually thought, doctors would tell me you'd be lucky if you're going to live till the end of the week, week in and week out, you know. And from the second she was born, she gave me the strength and the motivation and inspiration just to keep going and fighting, and, you know, and she's just a blessing. Words can't even describe how she makes me feel when I'm with her. You know, I feel no pain when I'm with her. She's just the most beautiful creature on this planet, you know, and I'm doing all of this for her, you know, so I can leave her something to be proud of. And you know, it's like the other day she woke up next to me and she goes, "Papa, you know something? When I grow up, I want to be just like you." I was like, "No, you don't." You know, but it really, really touched me, you know. And she
you
looks
know what,
up to me
though?
Like,
she knows you, and she knows the affection that you give her and the love that you give her, because she wants to be just like you. She sees your admiration,
yeah,
and she sees how touching you are with her, that she knows you're a good and phenomenal man. So she feels that, but as part of your book and your inspiration towards, you know, what you've been through, and a lot of people give up. You know, I mean, if Angelina was not born, I don't know when she was born.
She was born in 2006.
But at what point? I mean, was it after you were rehabilitating yourself that she was born, or it has to be, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, after the 2 years in bed, I wrote for 2 years and I never touched what I had written again. And it was only once she was born that I started writing again and put it all together for her, you know?
The admiration and the inspiration and the spirituality came out because you had something to live for.
Exactly.
Okay. And with everything and everyone that is listening in tonight, what could you say to them with everything? I've been listening to the show and I've heard about addiction. And there are some people that could, you know, be to the point where they can't get out of it. And yes, AA, NA, any meetings that they go to, if they're not strong enough and have willpower, to not go forward. But I understand what you went through with everything that has happened to you, and the fame and the fortune that you had and the money you had, but you know, as for me, I was on barely any money and I was addicted. So I spent my money. I had no gas. I had no heat. I lived on ramen noodles at times. And then finally I snapped out of it and I said, you know what? I said, I can't live like this anymore. But many people can't do that. But with you and with your inspiration of everything that, I mean, it's basically a godsend that things did happen to you in a way, because you were living a happy-go-lucky, destructive way, and in a manner that you just were not thinking about your health. But now that you are trying to get your health back, and I know you have health issues from what you've posted and what people know about you, how do you feel now that you're still having problems and complications with your health? And how do you feel that you're going to go forward with your life to keep on going and to create or recreate anything that you've written in that in your book?
Well, basically, like I said before, Angelina just is my reason for keeping going and keep on fighting, you know. And I've been through, they found out 2 weeks ago I have another aneurysm that's at the moment only 2 inches long on my aorta. You know, they've really replaced 3 feet of my aorta with an artificial one. But there's 6 inches of my natural aorta from my heart to my abdomen. And that's where the aneurysm is. And if it explodes, I'll die on the spot. So I've got the two best surgeons, one in Europe and one in London. I'm meeting them with them next week on the 23rd, and they've been discussing between them what they're going to do about it. They really don't want to open my heart up again, because they say to put me under anesthetic for another 10, 12, 13 hours like they did last time in 2009 could kill me. So, but I know I'll get through it. You know, I'm so positive and that I will get through it. I have no doubt in my mind. You know, because Angelina needs a papa and I'm going to be here for her, you know. And there's no doubt in my mind I'm going to get through this.
That's
it's just
great.
Positive thinking. You know, it's just positive thinking. You know, it's amazing. And the average person, I think, I don't know the exact percentage, it's like 2-5%, use 2-5% of their brain. You know, and it's just amazing how powerful your mind and your brain actually is. If you want to use it, it's available, and it's just up to you yourself to choose to use your brain to make it work and to make all your dreams come true and get over your addictions and your financial problems, your health issues, your addictions, any problem you have, but it's only you yourself that can do it, you know?
Well, I like to think of it this way. My last two brain cells were suing for damages. When I came in, what I found when I tell my sponsees usually is most folks don't have the kind of willpower. They've lost that ability. It's more like won't power. They just can't do it on their own. So I suggest a spiritual solution. If they can't stop drinking, get on your knees and ask God to remove the craving. That's what worked for me. That's what got me started. And then I went out from there. But, you know, you're kind of an exceptional guy, Spike. You know, most folks, you're not going to, you know, because you've been through hell and high water several times, and you're still pretty well on the edge. But to me, I have to do it a God-centered program. That's what works for me. So everybody's a little different the way they work it, but I find this to be more happy, joyous, and free for me. So if you want to give out, we got to close up. So if you want to close out with the information about how to find your book again, please feel free. Go ahead.
All right. It's on my website, www.anaughtythingcalledlife.com. You can read the synopsis on my book. You can leave messages on there. You can look at all my modeling portfolios and videos and things, and you can click on the link at the top right of the page where it says buy your book, and you can order the Kindle on there, or the PDF, or the paperback, and it's one hell of a read. And if my book doesn't inspire you or motivate you to sort yourself out, not much else will, to be honest. It's just It's quite a story.
Great. I'm glad you took the time and the effort. I hope the listeners got some. I know the lady who called in, Joy, she seemed to relate to you quite a bit. Everybody's going to relate on a different level to different folks, but I think it's important to keep an open mind. You never know what's going to touch that next individual with your story. Not everybody, but yeah. There's somebody out there that's going to be. I like to think, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we could see how that experience can help someone else. The further down you've gone, the more you can help.
Exactly.
Thanks again. On this, we'll close. Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're in 2,800. We're in 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and we just have gone over 300,000 hits to the website. There's no money being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. Even though we're not AA, I like to keep to that platform of understanding, because I believe anonymity is a spiritual platform, and God always goes first. So it's not about me. It's not about anything. It's about a God-driven program to help the next sufferer. So, again, thanks again, Spike, and remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
All right. Good night, Joe. Bye.